Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Jury Death Sentences in the Eighth Amendment Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On January 20th, 2016, the Supreme Court decided three consolidated death penalty cases, Kansas v. Carr, a second Kansas v. Carr. On January 20th, 2016, the Supreme Court decided three consolidated death penalty cases, Kansas v. Carr, a second Kansas v. Carr, and Kansas v. Gleason. A Kansas jury sentenced Sydney Gleason to death for killing a co-conspirator and her boyfriend to cover up the robbery of an elderly man. In a joint proceeding, a Kansas jury also sentenced brothers Reginald and Jonathan Carr to death for crime spree that culminated in the brutal rape, robbery, kidnapping, and execution-style shooting of five young men and women. The Supreme Court of Kansas vacated the death sentences in each case, holding that the sentencing instructions violated the Eighth Amendment by failing to affirmatively inform the jury that mitigating circumstances need only be proved to the satisfaction of the individual juror and that juror's sentencing decision, and not beyond a reasonable doubt. It also held that the Carr's Eighth Amendment right to an individualized capital sentencing determination was violated by the trial court's failure to sever their sentencing proceedings. The two questions before the U.S. Supreme Court were, 1. Whether the Constitution required the sentencing courts to instruct the juries that mitigating circumstances need not be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, and 2. Whether the Constitution required severance of the Carr's joint sentencing proceedings. By a vote of 8-1, the Supreme Court reversed the judgment of the Kansas Supreme Court and remanded the cases. Justice Scalia delivered the opinion of the court, which held that 1. The Eighth Amendment does not require capital sentencing courts to instruct the jury that mitigating circumstances need not be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, and 2. The Constitution did not require severance of joint sentencing proceedings because the contention that the admission of mitigating evidence by one defendant could have so infected the jury's consideration of the other defendant's sentence as to amount to a denial of due process does not stand in light of all the evidence presented at the guilty and penalty phases relevant to the jury's sentencing determination. Justice Scalia's majority opinion was joined by the Chief Justice and Justices Kennedy, Thomas, Ginsburg, Breyer, Alito, and Kagan. Justice Sotomayor filed the dissenting opinion. To discuss the case, we have Kent S. Scheidegger, who is Legal Director and General Counsel at Criminal Justice Legal Foundation. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Scheidegger.
On January 20th of this year, Justice Antonin Scalia delivered the opinion of the United States Supreme Court in the case of Kansas v. Carr, an opinion joined by all but one of his colleagues. Regrettably, it would be his last opinion for the court. The specific issues presented by the case involve federal constitutional limitations on procedure in state capital sentencing proceedings. Underneath the case, though, lie questions of judicial federalism and the role of the United States Supreme Court in reviewing decisions of the state courts on questions of federal law. Three cases were joined for argument and decision, but the two of greatest public interest were the cases of the Carr brothers and the notorious Wichita Massacre. The Carr brothers engaged in a crime spree of robbery and murder that culminated in a home invasion robbery of a house where five young men and women were present. Not content with stealing property, the Carr brothers put the victims through a three-hour ordeal of nearly unspeakable sexual depravity. Then they took them out naked into a snow-covered field and shot all five in the backs of their heads. One of the young women miraculously survived to testify. On these horrific facts, nearly every reasonable person would agree that if we are going to have capital punishment at all, this is the kind of case it is for. Yet the Kansas Supreme Court overturned the Carr brothers' sentences on two strained theories. First, it said the trial court's correct instruction that aggravating circumstances had to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, when combined with the lack of any mention of burden of proof as to mitigating circumstances, might have led some jurors to think that mitigating circumstances also had to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt to be considered. Second, it held that holding the sentencing proceedings for the brothers jointly rather than severing them was so unfair to both of them as to violate the Eighth Amendment. To understand the first holding and why the Kansas Supreme Court thought it was a federal constitutional question, we must step back into the United States Supreme Court's constitutionalization of capital sentencing procedure in the 1970s and 1980s. In 1971, the Supreme Court declared that the manner in which capital sentencing was conducted throughout the United States was not inconsistent with anything in the Constitution. The next year, the court flipped and said all existing laws were unconstitutional, but failed to provide any coherent explanation as to why. In 1976, the court reviewed five states' new capital sentencing laws, upholding three and striking down two. The reasons given were refined in a series of decisions, not always consistent over the next decade. The big picture was largely complete by the mid-1980s, although the court continues to tinker with the machinery to this day. The main structure of capital sentencing requires two decisions called eligibility and selection. This structure goes back to the 1962 draft of the Model Penal Code. In the eligibility step, the fact finder must find some aggravating fact from a list provided in state law that raises the crime above the basic elements of murder. These aggravating factors are similar to elements of an offense in that they cannot be excessively vague or subjective, and more recently the court has held that they must be decided by a jury and proved beyond a reasonable doubt. If no such fact is found, the defendant is not eligible to be sentenced to death. If the case clears the eligibility hurdle, it goes to the selection step. In this step, Justice Stevens wrote for the court in Zant v. Stevens in 1983, it is desirable to throw open the door to a broad array of factors. Limitation to predefined lists of objective factors is neither necessary nor desirable, and the state must allow the defendant to proffer any aspect of his character or record that he contends is mitigating. After considering the aggravating and mitigating factors, the sentencer, which is usually the jury, decides whether to sentence the defendant to death. Considering this structure as a whole, the idea that the jury would misinterpret its instructions and ignore any mitigating factor it did not find proved beyond a reasonable doubt is ridiculous speculation. Justice Scalia's opinion notes that mitigating circumstances only enter the picture within a process that is inherently a subjective judgment call, not objective fact-finding. The decision to let a murderer off with something less than death is an exercise of mercy, and it makes no sense to assign a burden of proof to such a subjective determination. The opinion of the court notes, quote, in the last analysis, jurors will accord mercy if they deem it appropriate and withhold mercy if they do not, which is exactly what our case law is designed to achieve, end quote. The Kansas Supreme Court's holding on severance fared no better with the High Court. Questions on when trials may be joint or must be severed are generally questions of state law and only rarely become federal constitutional questions. Yet in this case, the Kansas Supreme Court said that the joinder of the Carr brothers' sentencing proceedings violated the Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution. Whatever the merits of the severance question is a matter of state law, Justice Scalia wrote for the court, the idea that a joint trial was so fundamentally unfair as to violate the Constitution was, quote, beyond the pale, end quote. Harkening back to the principle of Zant v. Stevens, that the jury in the selection process should have as much information as possible, the court held that the greater information in the joint trial improves the accuracy of the verdict, and if greater information comes from the defendant's antagonistic cases for mitigation, so be it. Justice Sotomayor dissented alone. She did not say that the decision of the Kansas Supreme Court was correct, although she seems sympathetic to it. Her point was that the United States Supreme Court should not have taken the case up at all. In doing so, she revived an argument between Justice Scalia and Justice Stevens in another Kansas capital case 10 years earlier, Kansas v. Marsh. In that case, Justice Stevens wrote a dissent suggesting that the United States Supreme Court should not review cases where a state court has ruled in favor of a defendant on federal grounds, and Justice Scalia wrote a concurrence arguing to the contrary. Neither opinion was joined by any other justice. Justice Sotomayor begins by considering the decision of the state Supreme Court to be the action of the state as a whole. There is no reason for the United States Supreme Court to intervene in this case, she says, because, quote, Kansas has not violated any federal constitutional right. If anything, it has overprotected its citizens based on its interpretation of state and federal law, end quote. There are three problems with this assessment of the situation. First, while the state court is overprotecting murderers such as the Carr brothers, it is underprotecting the victims of crime. Second, the judiciary is not the state. The executive branch of the government of Kansas believes that the decision is wrong, and the state of Kansas is the petitioner asking for the Supreme Court's review. Third, the Kansas Supreme Court has violated a federal constitutional right. By making up new limitations on state authority that are not really in the United States Constitution, it has violated the 10th Amendment right of the people of Kansas to exercise, through the democratic process, all powers of government that are neither forbidden to them nor reserved to the federal government by the Constitution. A bit later, Justice Sotomayor does address the contrary positions of the two branches of state government. She writes, quote, "We intervene in an intrastate dispute between the state's executive and its judiciary, rather than entrusting the state's structure of government to sort it out," end quote. Justice Scalia's response on this point relies heavily on his concurrence in Marsh. Unlike Marsh, however, it is the opinion of the court and is joined by all of the other justices. Quoting his Marsh concurrence, Justice Scalia writes for the court, quote, "When we correct a state court's federal errors, we return power to the state and to its people," end quote. I think Justice Scalia has the better of the argument, though it can use some fleshing out. The process of making law within a given level of government is sometimes a dialogue between the judicial and legislative authorities, with the legislative side sometimes including the people of the state by direct vote. If a state court interprets a statute in a particular way, the legislature may come back with an amendment that abrogates the interpretation. If a state court interprets the state constitution to impose some requirement, the people can, if there is a broad enough consensus, abrogate that decision by amending the state constitution. For example, in the 70s and early 1980s, the California Supreme Court was notorious for inventing new constitutional limitations beyond those required by the Federal Bill of Rights. The people responded with a constitutional amendment that abolished the state exclusionary rule, among other reforms. However, if a state court stretches the interpretation of the United States Constitution in the defendant's favor, there is no dialogue, and the separation of powers is disrupted. There is nothing that the legislative or executive branch of the state government, or even the people themselves, can do to correct that erroneous interpretation. Only Congress can propose a constitutional amendment, and an error by one state Supreme Court is unlikely to produce the groundswell needed to get the required two-thirds of both houses. We cannot trust the state's structure of government to work it out, as Justice Sotomayor suggests, because the invocation of the federal constitution has taken the decision outside of that structure. That leaves review by the United States Supreme Court as the only available corrective measure. Justice Sotomayor says that the Supreme Court's correction of this error may be futile because the state court can reinstate the same result as a matter of state law. Yes, it can, but if it does, the state's legislature and people have remedies within the framework of the state constitution. Finally, it is important to note that Justice Sotomayor's proposed rule would cut off U.S. Supreme Court review of errors that favor defendants while preserving robust review for errors favoring the prosecution. Given the existence of federal habeas corpus review, this asymmetry is precisely backwards. A criminal defendant who receives an adverse and clearly wrong decision from the state courts can get relief in the lower federal courts on habeas corpus. No such review is available to the prosecution. A state Supreme Court decision in favor of the defendant on a federal question stands unless the U.S. Supreme Court reverses it, regardless of how clearly erroneous it may be. It remains binding precedent on all trial courts of that state, even if the Federal Court of Appeals for that circuit denounces it as clearly wrong in another case. Far from being unnecessary, then, United States Supreme Court review of erroneous state Supreme Court decisions in favor of criminal defendants is among the most necessary functions of that court. The High Court was right to review the Kansas Supreme Court's decision in the Wichita Massacre case, and it was right to reverse on the merits.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.